Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Mason Adams. This week, we listen back to some of our award-winning stories from 2023. Like this one, about the makers of Angelo's Old World Italian Sausage.
And they're like, man, I've never tasted anything like this before. So yeah, so go put your corporate sausage down and get some really good stuff here that has no preservatives in it.
We also go a-wassailing in Asheville, North Carolina. It's kind of like Christmas caroling with a kick.
Yeah, as you heard in the last song, we did ask for alcohol several times.
Okay. Do you want alcohol?
It's not like...
You just have some cups. I've not seen it.
And an Appalachian village witch wonders, how come we don't hear about more female cryptids?
Are all cryptids men? I mean, there's the Boojum, there's Mothman, there's the New Jersey Devil. Are they all boys?
You'll hear these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Mason Adams. In March, broadcast journalists from Virginia and West Virginia were recognized when the Virginia's Associated Press broadcasters met to present awards for notable stories produced last year. While awards aren't the reason we do what we do, it was gratifying to have the work of Inside Appalachia's contributors recognized. Today, we're replaying stories and interviews that received awards. Our first story is from Folkways unofficial foodie, Zach Harold. He took us to see how the sausage gets made with Angelo's Old World Italian Sausage. The recipe originated in the Calabria region of Italy, but it's made in West Virginia.
So we're going to make a mix here that's not mild or not hot, somewhere in between. How do you like it?
I'll eat anything.
Okay. So...
Louis Argento is elbow deep in a mixing bowl filled with ground pork and a closely guarded blend of spices. His dad, Sonny Argento, is supervising.
How do you say fennel in Italian?
Finocchio.
Finocchio.
This is crushed fennel.
No, this is whole fennel.
I mean, I'm sorry. It is not crushed fennel.
Most Italian sausages have use crushed fennel. We use whole seed, and you can actually see it.
We're in the dining room of Sonny's tidy little house in Charleston, West Virginia. Louie and Sonny are introducing me to the Argento family sausage, a recipe that's brought pride and acclaim to their Italian clan for nearly a century. Usually, once the meat is mixed together, the family stuffs it into natural sausage casings. But this time, Louie patties the mixture out like hamburger and throws it in a skillet. The Argentos like their sausage on pizza, in spaghetti sauce, or served on a hoagie bun, but they'll eat it for any meal of the day.
We like it with fried eggs and applesauce in the morning. You know, apples and pork generally goes well together. So we do applesauce or fried apples even better, with some toast on the side.
Sonny is 82 now, and he's been eating this stuff all his life. The recipe came from his mother's family, who hailed from the Calabria region of Italy. He grew up hearing stories about how his grandfather made it in the old country.
So they would chop the pork up with knives. I mean, they didn't have any electricity. They couldn't grind the pork. So they would chop it up as fine as they could get it, which wasn't very fine. Mixed the seasoning in it, and he had a hollowed out cow horn. My grandmother would clean the casings. If you don't know what a casing is, I'm not going to tell you.
I'll tell you. Their intestines. Natural sausage casings are animal intestines.
But she would clean the casings really well, and he would skinny them up on the cow horn and stuff it with his thumb.
Sonny's mother eventually taught the recipe to his father, Angelo Argento. His side of the family came from Sicily. Angelo actually came to West Virginia from Sicily when he was 6 years old. He became a coal miner at just 13. But when he wasn't below ground, Angelo was working for a local grocery store. By the time he was 26, he left the mines to start a store of his own, 3.5 miles up Powelton Holler in Fayette County. He called the little shop A. Argento and Company.
He said 2 men could stand fingertip to fingertip, and the other hands could touch the wall. But yet he sold almost everything in there.
That store only existed for about 5 years before it burned to the ground. Angelo didn't have any insurance, and he didn't have much in the way of savings. But he was already so well known for his work ethic and honesty that a bank in Montgomery loaned him the money to build a new store on little more than a handshake. He called this store Angelo's Market.
This guy had a fourth grade education, but nobody's fool. and you weren't going to beat him out of a nickel.
In 1960, young Sonny Argento found himself stationed in the mountains of Turkey with the U.S. Air Force. He was 20 years old, away from Fayette County, West Virginia for the first time, and chronically homesick. He borrowed another airman's reel-to-reel tape deck and recorded an audio message for his family back home. When they got it, they borrowed a reel-to-reel to make a recording of their own and mailed Sonny the tape.
I think my mother says the first words.
Hi, Sonny. How are you?
Everybody in the family passed around the microphone, telling them about ball games they won and report cards they got and colds they caught. When it was Sonny's dad's turn, Angelo made sure to give an update on the family meat shop.
And my dad said, we made some pepperoni this week.
Oh, you should have been here this week. We sure had some weather. It's been below zero. Mother and I made some pepperoni the other day.
Pepperoni is what Angelo called his sausage.
And sure was cold.
When he heard the tape, Sonny says he immediately pictured his father's grocery store, the meat shop and its big metal sausage mill with the feet nailed to the wooden carving block. He could see his father spooning the fragrant mix of coarse ground pork and spices into one end and turning the crank, and he could see his mother on the other end catching the long lengths of plump pink sausage as they spilled from the machine. It did very little to alleviate Sonny's homesickness. But after 5 years in the Air Force, he eventually made it back to Fayette County to help his father run the business. He took over completely in 1977, a few years before Angelo passed away. Sonny raised his five kids in that market, but you can probably guess where this is going. A small, family-owned store trying to stand against the tide of big-box megamarts and the dollar stores that seem to crop up in every Appalachian holler. More and more customers were lured away, and the Argentos just couldn't compete. Angelo's market closed in 2008 after more than 70 years in business. But here's the thing. The family didn't just lose the family business, as Louis Argento explained to me.
We had no need to go to Kroger or Walmart or any other store to shop. And when our store closed, we realized, which kind of sparked our business of today, that there was no quality Italian sausage in the stores.
So they just kept making it. First in Sonny's kitchen, and then in a makeshift meat shop they set up in his garage. Once family and friends found out, they started getting orders.
A lot of people, especially still the Italian-Americans around here, they like the sausage for their Christmas dinners or holiday parties. So next thing you know, we have an order for 500 pounds of sausage.
The demand was so great, Sonny decided maybe it was time to try a new kind of family business. There was a problem, though. It's fine to make sausage in your garage for family and friends, but the government doesn't really want you to sell it. Luckily, one of Sonny's friends owned a few grocery stores in Charleston and loaned the family the use of a meat shop. By making it there, the Argentos could sell their sausage in the store and offer it to local restaurants. They named their product Angelo's Old World Sausage. The label features an old photo of Sonny and his dad Angelo in ties and white aprons, grinning in front of the old store's meat case. They made the sausage in that grocery store meat shop for about 2 years, but they eventually outgrew the space. For one thing, they couldn't produce as much sausage as they needed, and because it wasn't a USDA-inspected processing facility, the Argentos couldn't sell their sausage in other stores. For a while, they considered building a factory of their own, but that was too big of an investment for such a small company. So they started looking around for a co-packer. After some searching, they found Wampler's Farm Sausage in Lenoir City, Tennessee. It's also a family business, albeit one with a modern solar-powered meat processing facility attached.
And I saw all these guys in white coats and a federal inspector walking around with their arms folded, and a tear came to my eye. I remembered my mom and dad standing over the meat block making sausage and me helping them. And occasionally my mother would have to put her finger in it and touch it to her tongue and say, it needs more salt. And I'm thinking that we can no longer do that.
Wampler's factory can turn out as much sausage as the Argentos will ever need. And everything is still made to the family's exacting standards, from the coarseness of the ground meat to the blend of spices that gives the sausage its flavor.
We sample every batch still. So, you know, we just want to, you know, as good as Wampler is, we want to make sure our sausage that our customers are buying is consistent.
Back in Sonny's kitchen, as the smell of fennel and frying pork filled the air, Louis told me the appeal of Angelo's sausage is as much about what doesn't go into it as what does. There are no binders or additives like you might find in big commercial sausages, and no preservatives.
And it's a joy to give people a bite of our sausage for the first time and see their face light up. And they're like, man, I've never tasted anything like this before. So yeah, so go put your corporate sausage down and get some really good stuff here that has no preservatives in it.
But the same economic forces that put Angelo's market out of business make it difficult for Angelo's Old World Sausage, too. Their products are now available in about 30 stores in West Virginia, Ohio, and Kentucky, but that growth has been a struggle. Louis says it can be difficult to convince managers to carry their product when every square inch of a chain grocery store's meat case is rented out to major corporate producers. And Angelo's isn't a big enough player to get into the big box store's warehouses, so their sausage doesn't appear in shopping apps. That's left the Argento family to depend on a more grassroots approach, one based on word of mouth and some social media advertising and setting up taste tests in grocery stores. They're confident that if they can just convince folks to take a bite, they'll be hooked.
Yeah, well, you want to take it in the dining room, Louis?
Okay, yeah. I'll get you guys some utensils.
Once the sausage was done, Sonny and Louie set the table with a loaf of sandwich bread and a jar of their home-pickled peppers.
Peppers? Yeah.
As we dug in, it was clear to see that even after a lifetime of eating this stuff, Sonny and Louie don't just take pride in this family recipe. They really enjoy eating it. And that's why they're pretty sure you will, too.
The big challenge is getting more people to try it and to realize that there is indeed a quality Italian sausage available in grocery stores. Sometimes it might cost 25 or 50 cents more, but it's worth it.
You know, I'll see him or I'll say, you want to try a piece of a sausage? And they'll say, no thanks, and they'll just keep on going. And I want to just run up and tap them on the shoulder and say, you don't know what you're missing. If you just give us a try.
Because at the end of the day, this isn't just sausage. It's the Argento family's most precious family heirloom. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Zach Harrell in Charleston, West Virginia.
Zach's story won for Best Mountain State Heritage, which is for West Virginia stories. It's Zach's fourth time winning the award. Most of the stories in this episode come from the Folkways Reporting Project, which raises awareness of folk traditions and practices, like wild food foraging. Gathering foods like ramps, sassafras, or blackberries from the forest has always been a part of Appalachian culture. In recent years, mushroom hunting has been having a moment. Folkways reporter Wendy Welch spent time with mushroom hunters in Virginia and West Virginia and brought us this story.
It's an overcast but hot morning, and I'm in the backseat of a car on the way to hunt for mushrooms.
Mushrooms have been so hot lately, they might be like the superstars, you know?
That's Amy McLaughlin. Her husband, Sean Means, is driving. We're talking about the mushrooms that are featured in the hit show The Last of Us. They're called cordyceps. In the show, cordyceps mutate and eat people's brains. In real life, they don't do that, at least not to people.
There are mushrooms that are parasitic, and they do have the same name, the genus, as the ones in that show. But at this time, we do not believe that they will inhabit human bodies. Well, they do take over bugs.
Bugs? Yeah, they absolutely do. Cordyceps, they get inside of the bugs, into their nervous system. And they do take over them. When the fungus is ready to produce the fruiting body, it kills the bug and comes up out of the bug.
Wow.
Sean and Amy are West Virginia master naturalists. They run a boutique vacation rental called Lafayette Flats in Fayetteville, next to the New River Gorge National Park and Preserve. They lead ecotours for people who stay in their flats, pointing out unique flora, fauna, and fungi in the area. If you want mushrooms in your life, there are two main paths to follow, farming or foraging. Misidentifying a fungus to use as food or medicine can be lethal. So foragers tend to hunt in packs until they're experts. Experienced hunters like Amy and Sean teach the newbies. As we disembark, Sean quotes a proverb known to every mushroom enthusiast in America.
There are old mushroom hunters, and there are bold mushroom hunters, but there are no old, bold mushroom hunters.
In other words, it's a good idea to be careful when hunting fungi. The couple lead me into the forest. Birdsong fills the air, and dry leaves crackle underfoot. Which is a bad sign, Sean points out. Mushrooms proliferate after rainfall. A mushroom, known officially as a fruiting body, is the smallest part of a larger living organism that needs a lot of water and can cover miles, all out of sight to the human eye.
You're in the woods and you see the trees and you see the mushrooms, and then if you just stop and think, the vast majority of the fungus is underneath us, you know? And just think about that for a minute, like the dark soil, the earth underneath us, and that huge organism that's under there that's pushing all the fruiting bodies up. I think that's fascinating to think about.
There are also mushrooms that grow from wood rather than soil. But today we're hunting chanterelles, which do grow in the ground. It's not going well.
I don't see any mushrooms at all.
Chanterelles would have been easy to spot had any been around. They're popular for teaching new foragers because of their bright yellow color and distinctive fluted edges that make them look like a tiny trumpet. They're hard to mix up with any other mushroom, but not impossible.
There's one called a jack-o'-lantern mushroom, and it doesn't really, I mean, once you learn the difference, it doesn't look anything like a chanterelle. It has very different characteristics, but it's kind of the same color. So if you were a newbie and you just were, you know, going through the woods and saw that collar, it's possible you could get excited. And those are poisonous. They're not going to kill you, but they're going to make you sick.
We find the target of our hunt after just a few minutes, but it's a disappointment.
One chanterelle, and it's old.
Not every mushroom hunt is successful. After another fruitless half hour, we leave the woods. Lucky for me, Sean and Amy have promised to take me back to their house and cook up some mushrooms they've already foraged. In their well-appointed kitchen, decorated with mushroom art, Sean hauls a double handful of fungi foraged yesterday from the fridge. When I find out the plan for eating the chanterelles, though, I briefly consider making a run for it. Sean cooks down the little fluted trumpets in butter until they're lightly crispy, mixes in a small amount of honey, and serves this over vanilla ice cream.
And now we eat.
It turns out that chanterelle ice cream sundaes are actually very tasty.
Oh, good. Wasn't it good?
Mm. Mushroom hunting with experts is also a rare treat. But if learning to identify the roughly 2,500 species that grow in central Appalachia feels daunting, try mushroom farming. It's safer, simpler, and less subject to the vagaries of rainfall. To home grow mushrooms, all you need is a log or a cardboard box and some spawn.
Well, we are mushroom farmers for 8 years, but originally we started on log and buying spawn and inoculating logs, and then moved on to buying spawn and growing oysters in straw.
That's Ben Harder. He runs Den Hill Farm and Fungi in Christiansburg, Virginia. The farm offers workshops on cultivating fresh mushrooms, and business is booming. One of his most popular workshops teaches people to inoculate logs with spawn, also known as mycelium. Inoculating a log means drilling a hole and pushing the mycelium into the wood. There it will feed and be fed in a symbiotic relationship, taking in carbohydrates from the log, then pushing out B vitamins and minerals like potassium through the fruiting body. I caught up with Harder while he was vending at the Blacksburg Farmers Market, and he shared his personal entry story into mushroom farming.
I started a vegetable farm. I was a horticulture student. Things were going all right, but one day at the farmer's market, a Appalachian Trail thru-hiker that happened to live in Blacksburg was coming through, and they were trying to sell these shiitake logs that they had inoculated so that they could finish the Appalachian Trail. It was amazing to see this log that probably had a pound and a half or 2 pounds of mushrooms growing out of it. It just kind of blew my mind that mushrooms were taking this waste product, a log worth, you know, nothing but firewood, and making a high value retail product out of it. You know, they're making something out of nothing. And so he sold me the logs. That year I killed them because I left them inside a barn and they dried out. But the next year I started inoculating logs. And from there, it's kind of been a steady growth.
In just a couple of years, they went from vending 100% fruits and vegetables to 40% produce and 60% fungi. Their best-seller home-growing method isn't logs, though. It's a countertop kit.
Doing the tabletop farm or the mushroom fruiting block on your counter, it's really quite the experience. It looks so beautiful. It's like a living bouquet.
Countertop box kits were everywhere during the pandemic, and they've stuck around. Harder sells bags of spawn you put in your own box. Walmart sells cardboard blocks full of specific spawn. Stash the open box in a dark corner of your kitchen counter. Keep it wet but not soaking, and in a couple of weeks,
you can just kind of see it come, and then when it's at prime, you get to just pluck off the mushrooms and eat them. And they even last a while in the fridge. You can keep them for a week or two. So it's a lot of fun and like a learning experience to see how mushrooms work and be able to get to do it again in 2 weeks because most of them fruit again. It's a real blast.
And educational. Den Hill sells the bulk of their fungal products to families with young kids.
It's really been amazing seeing the youth, especially like 5 to 12 year olds, that are really showing interest in coming out of the woodwork.
Mushrooms tend to capture young imaginations for many reasons, not least because they capture environmental toxins. When Harder explained this to me, his enthusiasm was infectious.
When mushrooms eat toxic chemicals like plastics or oil spills, like oyster mushrooms can live on an oil spill, clean it, and produce safe mushrooms to eat. It's really incredible.
Harder also delights in vegans and experimental chefs growing tabletop farms for the joy of eating those fresh fruiting bodies, sometimes as an alternative to meat. Two of the most popular countertop mushrooms are lion's mane, which tastes like lobster, and oyster, which tastes like mushrooms. When it comes to a kitchen kit, the world's your oyster.
We probably have 24 different types of mushrooms in our like culture library that we're actively growing.
The farming and foraging worlds aren't mutually exclusive. Most mycelium appreciation communities tend to be friendly with each other regardless of methodology. Harder thinks this is in part because mushrooms are so hyperlocal.
So I think mushrooms create community by having to be a decentralized system where cultures and strains and mushroom fruiting bodies can be sold and traded locally because of their lack of shipability and kind of regional availability.
Kits bring mushrooms safely and easily into your home. For the thrill of a woodland hunt, don't go it alone. Hunt down a mushroom club. They're prolific in Appalachia. Foraged or farmed, fungi can be fantastic fun. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Wendy Welch.
Wendy's story about chanterelles was awarded second place for Best Light Feature by the Virginia's Associated Press Broadcasters. The story is notable for another reason. It was not only Wendy's first folkway story for Inside Appalachia, but in fact, her first radio story ever. Coming up.
Yeah, as you heard in the last song, we did ask for alcohol several times.
Okay. Do you want alcohol?
It's not like... You guys have some cups. I've not seen it.
Don't put your coats away just yet, because we're going wassailing in Asheville. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Mason Adams.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University, educating the people of our region and beyond for more than 150 years. More information at concord.edu.
Not many folks are thinking about winter holiday traditions this time of year. But back before Christmas, Folkways reporter Rebecca Williams explored the old English tradition of wassailing in Asheville, North Carolina. A group of friends there got into this old singing tradition as a way to connect to their roots. Here's the story.
On a cold December night in Asheville, North Carolina, a group of about 20 people are gathering on a stranger's front porch. Some of them have been coming together for the past decade to celebrate the holidays, build community, and most important, wassail. One of the wassailers knocks on the door.
We're wassailers, and we would like to sing you songs.
I'd be delighted.
Lily White, Lily, oh, Lily White Pin, please to come down and let us come in.
Sarah Lynch Thomason leads the Asheville group. At 36 years old, Sarah wears her dark hair short on one side and long on the other. Tonight, she sports a bright red scarf and a cluster of bells that ring when she walks. She explains that wassailing is a centuries-old tradition with English roots.
The term wassail comes from an Anglo-Saxon phrase that meant good health. So it was a toast to good health. So wassail itself was a drink usually made from ale and cooked apples and a lot of spices that would be served in households often again around Twelfth Night or Christmas time or New Year's, and coincided with a tradition in the Middle Ages of working class folk, peasants, going to the homes of the wealthy and having this customary charitable exchange where the working people are singing to and blessing the wealthy master and mistress of the house. And in exchange, they're being gifted food, they're being gifted cider and wassail, and they're being often gifted money as well.
Bring us some cider, we'll drink down.
Tonight's wassailers don't ask for money, but after singing at a house decorated with bright holiday lights, they do ask for another gift.
Yeah, as you heard in the last song, we did ask for alcohol several times.
Okay. Do you want alcohol?
You guys have some cups. I've seen it.
Wassailing isn't your typical round of Christmas caroling. It's more mischievous. And that's something that the Asheville group takes very seriously.
This was a really fun and rowdy tradition, and it eventually got displaced by caroling in the Victorian era. You know, it was considered kind of too rambunctious by the emerging culture. And so the spirit of what we're trying to return to is that kind of raucous, fun feeling of these strangers with a party showing up at your door.
In fact, wassailing developed such a bad reputation for public drunkenness, it was banned by the Puritans in England and was highly discouraged by religious leaders who settled in the U.S. But recently, the tradition has had a renaissance in both England and America. One wassailer, Lila Weinstein, has been with the group for about 5 years. She explains what draws her to this tradition.
I love the old songs. I love ballads. I love all the medieval imagery. And then just the camaraderie of singing together and, you know, lighting up the night with some song.
For Caleb Magoon, tonight is an excuse for a really good time. And it's a way of connecting to others.
It's just getting together with people every year that you might not see otherwise, you know, and having a fun time being silly.
But members of the Asheville group aren't just drawn to wassailing because of the rowdy good time and the sense of community. For participants like Aaron Gann Clark, it's also a way to connect with the traditions of their ancestors.
I think that for me, like, I was raised in a Catholic faith, and so I always knew about Christmas caroling, but I feel like these songs that are older are connecting me to my well ancestors and like more ancient roots, and I just dig it. It feels good in my body.
Most of the wassailers here in Asheville are white, and wassailing seems to help them connect to their ancestral traditions and ethnic identity. For Sarah and many of her white peers, they feel disconnected from a sense of ethnic identity. And Sarah says that here in the U.S., that's by design.
There's been a long and very purposeful project of making people white here, of having people forget their ancestral identities and becoming white as a way to create racial hierarchies and reinforce white supremacy. When you came off the boat, you know, whatever period, there was a project here of making you become white and forget your ancestral languages and traditions. And so today, white folks in this country are experiencing a lot of grief and have a lot of yearning for ancestral practices.
Sarah has experienced this grief of ethnic ambiguity firsthand. And when she was in her mid-20s, she decided to learn about the traditions of her ancestors.
In my case, I have ancestors from England, Ireland, Scotland, Germany, Scandinavia, kind of all over the place. And there's several hundred years of separation from any of the traditions from those places. So, you know, I've sought out and learned from other people English folk songs, Scottish ballads.
Sarah says that connecting with these English and Scottish folk songs has had a big impact.
And there's something really powerful to me about speaking words and singing songs, holding those vibrations, those words, those forms of knowledge in my body, and knowing that people in my ancestry also sang these songs and held these words.
The boar's head, as I understand, is the...
But it's not always easy to learn songs and rituals that haven't been passed down from generation to generation. There are challenges to singing a 700-year-old song. During rehearsal, the Wassailing group struggles with Latin pronunciations.
Servire, like, I'm sure this is wrong. Let us servire, I'm changing it as I do it. Let us servire cantico. Let us servire cantico.
That's some Latinglish right there.
It's messy trying to reconfigure a 15th century English tradition for 21st century Asheville. But Sarah says that it's important that white folks make the effort to learn about their ethnic identities and the practices of their ancestors.
When we aren't able to connect to those practices, we end up appropriating and attaching to other cultures, indigenous cultures and African American cultures. And it's really important to understand that in indigenous history here and in African American history, song and dance traditions and many spiritual traditions were illegal for a very, very long time. We have to think about how painful that is then for white folks to then be trying to borrow or utilize those traditions without much context for them when we, as white people, actually have those traditions in our ancestry that we can be seeking out in a healthier way.
Oh, Christmas is past, 12th night is the...
Back on the porch, as the group finishes singing, one of the people in the house returns with a bottle of wine. And one of the Wassailers, Rochelle, slips on a costume that looks like it's made out of red and blue rags. She's wearing a wreath on her head that's wrapped in fake ivy with battery-operated candles on top. A sure cue that we're no longer in the Middle Ages.
Spirit of earth and light, traveling.
The spirit of the new year emerges from behind the singers and dances up to the owners of the house to make a toast.
Did everyone get wine?
I just think we so badly need community, and there are so many ways that our current culture divides us from each other and isolates us from each other. And when you get people together to sing together, something really, really powerful happens for us, and it happens in our bones. It happens at like this molecular level, and we need it. And so to create that with a group of people and then bring that as a gift to others, to say, hey, we are, even if you're feeling isolated in your home or isolated in your community, we show up and we sing to you. That's a powerful gift.
We have traveled many miles over hedges and stiles.
For Inside Appalachia, this is Rebecca Williams in Asheville, North Carolina.
Rebecca's story won first place in the Best Light Feature category from the Virginia's Associated Press broadcasters. Who doesn't love a good animal story? In 2023, Radio IQ's Roxy Todd accompanied biologists who were studying the tiny, endangered bog turtle. Habitats for reptiles are disappearing, and biologists were trying to find out how many of these rare turtles still exist.
I was warned before I went There was hardly any chance that I'd see a bog turtle. They're tiny and like to hide.
Rarely, even if you know there's bog turtles in an area, will you ever see one.
Amy Roberts has only seen a few, and she's been researching them for years with the Amphibian and Reptile Conservancy, along with Mike Knorr.
Bog turtles are 3 or 4 inches long, and they have a big orange-reddish patch behind their eye as well, which is pretty typical for the species, pretty iconic. I think they're beautiful.
The bog turtle was in the headlines earlier this year after organizers of Floyd Fest announced they'd hit delays in the permitting process for their new property in Floyd County. They canceled this year's music festival, and some people went on social media blaming the bog turtle as the culprit. In fact, the turtle had nothing to do with Floyd Fest's postponement, says one of the festival organizers, Sam Calhoun.
Harming anything is kind of the antithesis of Floyd Fest from the very beginning. We're doing everything by the book so we can protect anything that needs to be protected.
Even though they haven't seen any bog turtles on their property, Calhoun says they've adjusted their construction plans to keep the wetlands untouched. The main risks to bog turtles are their disappearing habitats as housing developments and roads replace these bogs and landowners ditch or drain the swamps. Floyd County actually has some of the best preserved bogs for these turtles, says state herpetologist J.D. Klepfer.
It's like the good Lord just took a pepper shaker and just shook out these little wetlands all over Floyd County.
Bog turtles have existed in these mountains for at least 10,000 years. If you look at a photo of these things, your heart may seriously melt. They're so cute, in fact, they go for big money on the black market and poachers steal them. Today, they're listed as endangered in Virginia, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is considering adding southern populations of bog turtles to the list of federally protected endangered species. So I had to promise never to disclose our location when I accompanied the biologist to watch as they set up camera traps.
It's a lot of work to survey all these wetlands around this area.
Muddy water sloshes around our legs as we move through tall grasses, beautiful swamp rose flowers, and a strong-smelling plant called swamp cabbage. And then we spot a bog turtle nest with 4 eggs.
It makes me so excited. It's so beautiful.
Cool, guys.
But I've never seen eggs.
The news is also a shock to the landowner. He was completely unaware that bog turtles live on his property. In a month, the scientists will take the cameras back to their lab, where they'll analyze thousands of photos to see how many bog turtles and other animals they can spot. In 3 years, they hope to have a better sense of how many bog turtles still live in the mountains of Appalachia. In a bog, somewhere in Floyd County, I'm Roxy Todd.
That was former Inside Appalachia producer Roxy Todd, who's now the New River Valley Bureau Chief at Radio IQ. We aired Roxy's bog turtle story last fall. It placed second in the Best Old Dominion Heritage category for stories reported in Virginia. Radio IQ won a bunch of other awards as well. Congratulations to Roxy and all our friends at Radio IQ. A lot of people are fascinated by witchcraft. Just check the New Age section of your local bookstore. In Appalachia, witchcraft goes way back, but it's still around today. Wise women still practice herbology. They trace the patterns of the moon, just like their mothers and grandmothers did. H. Byron Ballard is a practicing witch in Asheville, North Carolina. She's also the author of several books, including her latest, Small Magics, Practical Secrets from an Appalachian Village Witch. Last fall, she spoke with producer Bill Lynch about her way of life and quizzed Bill on cryptids.
Byron, first, thanks for coming on Inside Appalachia. It's a pleasure to speak to you. It's not very often I get to speak to an actual Appalachian village witch. So you may be the first. You may be.
I don't know, Bill. I listen to this show, and I'm pretty sure you've probably talked to a witch or two already. They just might not identify that way.
Well, just to kind of get as a getting to know you sort of thing, how did you become such a thing? How did you become an Appalachian village witch?
Well, I mean, I took that on as a branding thing, just to be honest. I mean, I'm Appalachian multiple generations back. And I've been a witch my whole life. My mother's family all identified themselves and were identified with that word back to like five generations that I know of. So I've always been that. And then when it came time for me to kind of have a hat rack to hang all my hats on, mm-hmm. that felt like a good one. So I called myself the Village Witch. And I know some people who function as Village Witches in Britain. And one of them contacted me and she was like, well, what exactly is it you do that you think you're a Village Witch? And I said, well, I go out and I bless the cornfields and I used to bless the tobacco crop and I'll come out and clear your house if it's got something uncomfortable in it. And I'll bless your babies and I'll, you know, bury your grandmas and, you know, all that stuff. And my friend said, oh, well, no, that's exactly what a Village Witch does. And I said, well, yeah.
Witchcraft or being a witch in the 21st century, how is that different than being a witch in the 20th century or even the 19th century?
I would say it's less threatening than it used to be, but in some places it's still just as threatening. How is the role different? That's a really good question. I mean, for people like me, the role isn't any different, obviously. I'm going to do a baby blessing. I'm going to do a hand fasting when people want to get married. I will do a funeral, all that stuff that people traditionally did. Plus, right now, I've got tinctures laid up in the dining room that I have to remember to go in and shake every day so that they're going to be good next month. So I do a lot of those similar things. But something that we have the ability to do now and the privilege to do is that I can openly talk about it and I can openly teach it to other people. So people don't have to rely on reading a book. Though, I mean, I'm a writer. I want people to read all the books, but I can teach people face to face and I can tell them what works for me and what doesn't work for me and encourage them to do those things that they feel like they're drawn to do, but maybe don't have the courage or the confidence to try. So that's one big difference. But the practice itself, I don't know that it's really changed. We joke about there's a ceremonial magic, and then there's what I do, which is sort of, I reach in my pockets and see what's in my pockets, and I go pull a little plantain and some rabbit tobacco and stir it all together. And for some people, there is a sense of witchcraft being a very high-ordered religion. And you will hear some people talk about that they are a member of a witchcraft religious tradition. But for people like me, it's not necessarily a religious thing, though it is connected with spirits and with spirit things, but it's not necessarily a religion.
Let's talk a little about folklore. Places like the United Kingdom have pixies and elves in Europe, and we have goblins, haints, and the Mothman. Don't forget the Mothman. Did we bring our fairies and spirits over with us when we immigrated from Europe or wherever, or were they already here?
I'm going to say yes to both of those, because I think already there are spirits that are attached to land. And these are some of the oldest mountains in the world. And how could they not have spirits attached to them? But I also think that a lot of my people, certainly, they brought some of that with them. And they absolutely brought the folklore with them. But now you bring up Mothman, and I've got a question for you.
Oh, no.
Are all cryptids men? I mean, there's the Boojum, there's Mothman, there's the New Jersey Devil. Are they all boys?
Well, that's a good question. So I can't say for sure. West Virginia has something like 22 or 23 different cryptids. I don't know whether they're all male or whether there are any females in there. That's a good question. I'll have to put that to the Mothman Museum, maybe. You consider yourself a keeper of tradition. Okay, what sort of traditions need to be kept?
Well, it's interesting to me because, I mean, obviously I'm a native of this area. What happened for me back in, golly, 2008 or 9, I was invited up to Harvard to do a colloquium called Forging Folklore. I presented a paper, you know, it's a colloquium, it's a 20-minute paper, and then there's a Q&A session. We've all done them. And I did a paper about Appalachian folk magic, and I called it Hill Folks Hoodoo and the Question of Cultural Strip Mining. And it was a kind of lamentation about a culture that I felt was fading as more and more people came into the region. So out of that paper came my very first book, which I thought would be my last book, my only book. It's called Staubs and Ditchwater, a friendly and helpful introduction to Hill Folks Hoodoo. A little slim primer of a book where I just wanted to write down all the stuff that I remembered and that I practiced and that my cousins taught me, you know, all that stuff. And then I went out on tour with that book, as one does. And I was in Raynell, West Virginia, as a matter of fact. I'd been up there to visit some friends, and I was in a closed elementary school. I just had a bunch of mason jars full of stuff and talked about what I do and what my family had always done and the people around me. And I came to find out that I was premature in thinking that this practice was fading, because there were still plenty of people who were doing it, but they just weren't on social media calling themselves whatever they call themselves. They just were doing it the way it had always been done. Everybody knew that if they went to Miss Renee, she knew what to do about toothache. And everybody knew if they wanted to dig a new well, they had to go to Uncle Walter, because Walter always could douse for water. And so it was all still there. It just wasn't where I was seeing it. So that made me jump with joy, of course. But it made me keep writing, because I just kept collecting more and more and more. I started thinking about the song catchers that were here at the beginning of the last century. And they'd come into these hollers and fastnesses, and they'd hear music on somebody's porch. And they'd go, "Well, good heavens, I believe that's Child Ballad 714, Barbara Allen." And so they started tracking the music back to its source. So I started tracking Appalachian folk magic back to some of its sources. And I've been calling myself a spell catcher. So I go back to Britain every 3 or 4 years or so, and I hang out in the borders between Scotland and England. And I just go and talk to people about what their practices are to see if I can find commonalities between the things that we do. That's one of the sources of our folk magic down here in the Southern Islands. And also the Pennsylvania Dutch people, the Dutch. I went up and hung out with them and spent some time in their library and had a great time researching things like the Song of the Churn.
The new book, Small Magics. What would you like to tell me about that one?
It came out of a fight on social media, if you can imagine such a thing. I've been teaching a class now for, well, pre-COVID, so probably 6 years, that I call Simple Practical Magic. And it's the building blocks of doing the energetic magical work that I do. I was observing an argument on Facebook, and I said, "Good Lord, people, do I need to write a book of my simple practical magic class?" And people were enthusiastic about that, as was my editor at Llewellyn. So it basically is that class, and it's just the building blocks of any kind of magical practice.
We're at the part of the year where there's certain days, Samhain, and then the winter solstice, right?
Right. And we actually pronounce that Samhain.
Samhain. Okay.
Samhain. That's good though. Samhain is like a triple hitter holiday. It is the third harvest. It is the end of the, I guess I would say, liturgical year. It's the end of the year. And it's also the new year. So there's a lot that goes on in that period between October the 30th and then November the 2nd or 3rd. We do it honoring the ancestors, which Southerners, I'm telling you, we have got the market cornered on that, because we've been doing that for years. And then from that point until the winter solstice is the darkest time of the year. I mean, literally the darkest time of the year. If we look to nature about how we do things, that's when nature rests. So it's a glory in October. And you live in a place like I do where you're going to be inundated with tourists who are coming to see the colors, and you're not going to want to be on the road. And then what happens once those colors fade is a lot of those people go home, and we should have some quiet time. We should be able to rest ourselves as the soil rests, as the earth rests. But what do? We schedule two of the biggest, loudest holidays ever during that time. So you don't even have time to rest before it's Thanksgiving, and you've got to figure out who is baking the pie this year, and which pie is it going to be? Is it going to be sweet potato, which half the people love, or is it going to be pumpkin, which the other half love? So you end up making two pies that taste basically the same. Once you get done with that, then you're into the fury and flurry of Christmas. So we don't take the time as a culture to rest like we should.
Byron, thanks for talking with me.
It's been delightful. Thank you so much, Bill. Appreciate you.
That was Village Witch and author H. Byron Ballard. Bill's interview with her won the award for Best One-on-One Interview. We also want to congratulate WVPB reporters Emily Rice and Brianna Heaney, news director Eric Douglas, and Us and Them host Trey Kay. You've heard them on Inside Appalachia, and all of them won awards from the Virginia's Associated Press broadcasters. Till next time, thanks for joining us as we journey throughout Appalachia. Our theme music is by Matt Jackford. Other music this week was provided by Christian Lopez, Dave and Tim Bing, John Ingram, Marissa Anderson, Frank George, and Hank Williams Jr. Bill Lynch is our producer. Xander Alloy is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Eric Douglas. Kelly Libby is our editor. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. We had help this week from Folkways editors Chris Julin and Nicole Musgrave. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org/insideappalachia to subscribe or stream all of our stories. Or look for Inside Appalachia on your favorite podcast app. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University, focusing on students' futures. Classes available at concord.edu/apply.